But welcome, Lori. It's a Rhyme Tovim to everybody. This is part 9, I believe, of our series of women ritual texts, men, women, and ritual textual analysis. And part 3, which was originally going to be 2 parts, but I think it's very good. Like I told many of our speakers, if it takes more time, it takes more time. So part 3 on Mechitza. So Bakasha, Lori, we're looking forward to closing the walls or expanding the walls, however you want to say. Okay, Bakasha.
Okay, thank you very much. I just saw there was someone just sent dramatic news on the chat. I'm going to try to focus. And as usual, Bezrat Hashem, we'll get to a lot of questions at the end, which I really enjoy hearing from you, your observations and your questions over the course of this year. It's great for me. Few very quick points before we get into what I want to talk about tonight, which is out of shul, because we've been pretty focused on mechitza in shul. The few quick points are this. Number one, maybe it goes without saying, but maybe it doesn't. I just think it's something that's worth pointing out. We talked a little bit, and in particular, we saw it reflected in the Sri De'esh, the idea that part of the halachic discussion of mechitza really should be the experience of women in the prayer space. That's something that belongs in a tshuva about mechitza, no less than considerations of what being more or less aware of women present, how that might affect men, or something like that. And it's just important to point out here that different people really like different things. It's not really that easy. If anyone here has ever had the experience of trying to work with the shul on making adjustments to a mechitza or putting in a new mechitza, it's sometimes surprising just how much of a range there is between what different people want. So there's a whole school of thought that people who really specifically want side-by-side mechitzot as much as possible. And there are also a lot of people, a lot of women, who really want to feel very much like they're in sort of like a safe, enclosed space. And it's not always predictable. I have some friends who one might think of as like pretty kind of, I guess you could say, modern or liberal, and who dafka specifically when they daven, they want to feel like they can use their bodies for prayer. Kol atzmotai tomarna, all my bones should say to you, to you, God, your praise. There's a sense of, prayer can be ecstatic. They talk about Rabbi Akiva, that when he would pray, he'd start in one corner of the room and he'd end up in the other corner. There can be a real physicality to prayer. So it's just important to keep in mind that it's not just the halachic factors. There really are a lot of different people looking for a lot of different things. And it's not necessarily so easy to please everybody, because it's not an automatic thing that, of course, any thinking man or woman would want mechitza this way. Not at all. And halacha isn't the only reason why that's not clear cut. So I just wanted to put that out there. The next point is something that came up at the end of last year, and I thought it was really important to just discuss. And that's sort of like the status of the women's section. So you have the women's section. Is the women's section part of shul? And this comes up classically in halachic discussion. This comes up, we had that sign last week about, men stay out of the women's section from a shul in Teaneck. But classically in halachic discussion, this does come up in terms of men. It comes up in the following way. I mean, a lot of men in particular will use the women's section as a sort of anteroom, like a place to like put on their tefillin with before they go into shul or something like that. It's sort of like, the safe latecomers corner. There's all kinds of reasons why a man might find himself interested in being in the women's section, certainly if women aren't there yet. But the thing is, so it comes up in halachic discussion. Well, is a man who davens in the women's section, is he actually able to join a minyan? And that actually has implications for what it means for a woman to be in a women's section. So let me see if I can get the share screen going. Okay, I'm hopeful, but please bear with me if it takes a little longer than we would like. And did it work? No, it did not. I'm going to try this again. Oh, it did, and then we lost it. Okay, let me try this again. I'm hoping it works this time. Yes, here we are. Okay, it's always so nice when things work. Okay, so here we just have a little machloket between the Archa Shulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, and they're talking about, you know, so this guy in women's section, and he wants to help make the minyan. Can the 10th man be in the women's section? And it depends. The Archa Shulchan says pretty clearly no. For sure, the men in the women's section can't join with the people in Beit HaKnesset. Even though there are windows between them. Even if they can make eye contact, says the Aruch HaShulchan, nope. If they're really full-fledged mechitzot, these are like two spaces. Now, of course, once he says if they're really full-fledged different spaces, they can't join, even with the window, that starts leaving open the possibility that the mechitzo might be constructed a little differently, there could be room. The Mishnah Berurah says differently. The Mishnah Berurah says, Pashut, ha'omdim be'ezra nashim, it's clear. Those who stand in the Ezra's nashim, uv'mechitzam of seket, yesh chalom, u'mar'elehem panav, misham, mitzarefim ma'em la'asara, your 10th man can be in the women's section. And by the way, of course, these kinds of discussions have come up in a completely different way right now with COVID, of course. An outdoor minyanim, can the guy on this porch join in with the guy at his neighbor's balcony? Not our subject, though. But still, Mishnah Berurah is saying very clearly, as long as there's a window and they can make eye contact, they can join together for a minyan. And now here's the really important line. The kol shekin, how much more so? That if there's already a minyan without the guy in the women's section, the fact that there is a window there makes what he's doing considered to be tefillah b'tzibur. He is participating in public prayer. And that, of course, is the critical point for us, because our essential question isn't so much, generally speaking, if a woman's going to be able to join a minyan, or that could be a whole other, that will be Bezrat Hashem a sheer topic here, but it's a different topic. Our question in the here and now is, when a woman is davening in the Ezra's Nashim, in what sense is she in shul? And based on this discussion here, where what's being limited is when there are full-fledged mechitzot, there's a question of limitation on a man being able to be part of the minyan. But what's not being questioned is that the man in the Ezra's Nashim, as long as there's some sort of, Mishnah Berurah is saying eye contact, Rav Henkin Zatzal actually in a tshuva says, well, as long as it doesn't reach the ceiling, that's enough. If the mechitza doesn't come to the ceiling, that's enough to say that these spaces are joined. Okay, but on the whole, halachic authorities are going to say that a woman in the women's section is participating, and so too a man, if a man were to be in the women's section, is participating in tefillah b'tzibur, is participating in communal prayer. So the question of minyan becoming part of a minyan aside, the most relevant question for women, generally speaking, in shul is, is she a part of this? There's chazarat hashatz. Is she a part of that? It's representing the entire community. And the answer is, being in the Ezra's Nashim is not going to get in her way, generally speaking, certainly when the mechitza does not go all the way up to the ceiling without any kind of break in it. Okay, so that's a really important point. But there's still another thing, which is sort of like a variation on this question, which is, you ever been, I remember there was a particular show I was, I attended at one stage of my life when I was a newlywed, actually, where on Shabbos, right after Kedusha of Musaf, the women's section became the Kiddush room. You ever been in a situation like that, where the women's section suddenly transforms into the meeting space or all-purpose space or something? That's actually more common than you might think. Of course, it's going to be particularly common in places that are short of space. But that's kind of another question. So fine, someone, a man or a woman, generally speaking, let's say it's going to be a woman in the women's section, there's tefillah b'tzibur, communal prayer is happening, they're part of it, no problem. But is that space itself sacred the way that a synagogue is sacred? Is it part of the shul in that sense as well, in terms of sanctity? And here actually we have a separate debate. So you have different opinions. Chochmat Adam, the Chochmat Adam says, no, it's not. De Ezra's Nashim Embo Kedusha Be Knesset Klal. From his perspective, the women's section does not have the sanctity of a shul. Now, of course, this whole time we have to keep in mind, different halachic decisors who are talking here might have different types of women's sections in mind. From his perspective, though, no sanctity, i.e. make as many kiddushes as you want. Usually you don't want to just be fressing in a shul. At least it's a halachic discussion if you should be eating in shul. How the shul is set up. Is it set up from the beginning conditionally to allow eating, that kind of a thing? But he's saying the women's section, certainly if he has in mind a separate space, no kedusha, no sanctity. The Tzitz Eliezer says, well, actually, yesh halut kedusha gam al ezrat nashim. He says, actually, no. The women's section does have sanctity as a space. But then he adds, and he says he's speaking for the majority of later authorities, I was a modim kimat ruva deruba shalaposkim, but almost the vast majority of halachic authorities would acknowledge she'ad kedei kedusha shel beit knesset atzmo lo bazeh. It's not quite the level of sanctity of the full shul. So according to these two opinions, we can understand how the women's section would be a better candidate for the kiddush room, let's say, than the men's section. It's still not necessarily the best way to facilitate women finishing their davening if it's not over. But if the idea is really that either the women's section doesn't have sanctity, or that it has sanctity but not exactly on the same level as the men's section, then we can understand a little bit more how the women's section sometimes becomes more of an all-purpose space in synagogue. But you should know that there is another opinion, and this is the opinion of the Aruch HaShulchan. And the Aruch HaShulchan says something that I personally find very powerful. V'chein, Beit HaKnesset Shel Nashim, Yesh Aleha Kedushat Beit HaKnesset. Beit HaKnesset Shel Nashim, it means the women's section, a woman's space, has the sanctity of the shul. Why? Kevan Shanashim Mitpalalot Sham. Because women pray there. He just says it very simply. He says, this question of comparing the levels of sanctity of different spaces within the shul, he doesn't think it fully registers. On the one hand, he's saying it might affect who can count towards the 10 of Minyan. He said that earlier, right? But on the other hand, when it comes to the fundamental nature of the space, from the Aruch HaShulchan's perspective, the women's section is still shul. Why is it still shul? It's there for people to pray. Women pray there. It's a sacred prayer space within your shul. It has sanctity. Full sanctity. So there's three different opinions on that level of sanctity of the women's section, and what you're going to do with your kiddush and where you're going to hold it might depend on where you fall out with those perspectives. Okay, now I want to get into what we're talking about today, and that's mechitza outside of shul. And in order to do that, I actually want to show you two different paragraphs juxtaposed. The first is from Rav Kook. The second is from a very modern Israeli Rav. I don't know, Rabbi Jay, if you've had him speak for you yet, Rav Yuval Shurlo. Have you ever done something with him? You have. I should have known. So Rav Shurlo is a very, very, very interesting and articulate national religious rabbi in Israel. Right now, he's very, very involved in all kinds of work on ethics, is his current focus. So at one point in time, I forget who sponsored this. I think it might have been Bnei Akiva. It might have been a group called Nemanei Torah VeAvodah in Israel. There's a group that sponsored Rav Shurlo writing up a kind of like halachic manifesto or position paper in favor of women and men mixing. In favor of there not being separation except for shul, in favor of limiting the idea of separation as much as possible. So I want to take a paragraph from that and a paragraph from Rav Kook and compare them to each other. Okay, so let's start with Rav Kook. And this piece by Rav Kook, this is from Midot HaRiyah. This is where he talks about different qualities, and here he's talking about tzniut, okay, modesty. Where modesty is something, of course, it's not just for women, it's for everybody. Midat ha-tzniut goremet tovot rabot ba'olam. Okay, the attribute of modesty, of tzniut, leads to a lot of benefits in the world. This is a kind of complex statement. You know, well, that's what you get when you try to learn Rav Kook. What's he saying? This, on the one hand, Siyut is really good. It's highly beneficial. On the other hand, because it's so beneficial, sometimes it overrides other things that might have otherwise been beneficial. What does he have in mind? Midat ha'ava v'hayedidut. The attributes of, you know, love or caring, friendship. B'chol ha'simanim v'adiburim anochem. All the ways that you signify that to someone else, all the ways that you speak to people that you care about. Haya ra'ui liyot shaveh bein haminim. Really, if you think about, says Rav Kook, if you think about the qualities of friendship, what it means to be connected to others, that's not, he says that ideally, in a certain sense, that shouldn't be gender dependent at all. That should be something that's fundamentally open, as it were, from soul to soul, irrespective of gender. But, here comes the but, aval, mipnei yikrat erech hatzniut nidchet midat derech eretz mimkoma. But because of how precious the value of tzniut is, this aspect of sort of derech eretz, which could mean something like norms or ways to behave or kind of positive, pleasant practices, this way of being gets pushed aside. So what is Rav Kook saying? He's saying, look, in some kind of fantasy world, everybody can really become close to everybody. And that's a very Rav Kookian idea, right? That the ability, the capacity of the soul to love and connect to others is unlimited and should be in some ideal way unlimited. But what can we do? We have this idea of tzniut, and we're not going to be able to manage it and maintain our tzniut, and therefore it gets superseded. Okay, that's what Rav Kook says. Now compare that to Rav Shurlo. Now, of course, look, Rav Shurlo is a tremendous Talmid Chacham. He's not the same as Rav Kook. At the same time, Rav Shurlo is certainly aware of our modern day society in a way that Rav Kook couldn't have anticipated to that level. Rav Shurlo says like this: Lo matzanu mikorot ha'oskim yishirut b'chevra b'rama yomyomit. He puts it on the table. He says, look, we just don't have enough halachic source material about how our society is supposed to function on a daily level. In given the dearth of sources like this, or the absence of them, and out of a particular spiritual orientation towards the relationship between Torah and life, pneinu or paninu el derech ha'eretz habsisit. We are turning towards fundamental, he uses the same phrase, it's very striking, fundamental derech eretz, elofio shel olamenu bo mitnalim gvarim v'nashim. And the fundamental way that our world works, where men and women move through this world. In some ways, he's really saying the opposite of what Rav Kook is saying. Rav Kook is saying, in some beautiful ideal world, men and women could connect freely. But we have to be realistic, and tzniut is a high value, so we have to give up on some of those relationships. And Rav Shurlo is saying, we don't have enough makorot about this to start with. Tzniut is great, but you know, if we're talking about life and what derech eretz means in our world, what it means for men and women to interact, how critical that is in so many aspects of many modern lives, we can't start saying that that's got to be pushed aside based on a value judgment. They both have a sense that there's a way in which maybe there could be a very natural way of men and women interacting. There's a way in which it's not entirely clear if that can be accomplished in concert with Torah values. But they both see the way to address that differently. In fairness, Rav Kook is talking in a very broad terms, and yet still they're both here acting sort of as visionaries. And it's a really interesting question that they're trying to envision, which is, you know, I think it's the kind of thing we don't talk about enough. We have a lot of conversations in our community about what's wrong with it. that can be productive. It having the conversation of what is our ideal, you know, like what would the ideal level of interaction between men and women look like? It's a little bit of a different conversation. And it's just, it's, I think it's very interesting to see the juxtaposition here of how differently how different these orientations are. And the reason why there's room for such variety in orientations to this question is because Rav Shurlo is right. He's right, not necessarily about his conclusions, but he's certainly right about one part of his premise. We lack material. Okay. When it came to talking about Mechitza in Shul, we also felt that we would have liked to have seen more classic materials about how it worked out. When it comes to how the genders are mixing in society, also, we do not have a lot to go on. There are a few really kind of like interesting little tidbits in the Talmud, but these tidbits don't solve our questions or resolve for us exactly what direction we should go in. So for example, here we have Abaye. It's talking about like on a wedding. The sugya, the context is in Masechet Kiddushin. It's talking about men and women being secluded with each other. So men and women being secluded with each other is often prohibited except for certain circumstances. You know, husband and wife can be secluded with each other, close family members, and there are all kinds of variations on that. But out of concern for this, at weddings, here's what they would do. Abaye dayar golfe. Abaye would put jugs on the ground. Rava dayar kana. Rav would put reeds on the ground. What are they talking about? It's basically they would put, like, let's say the men were kind of gravitating over here. Imagine like an outdoor, imagine like an outdoor picnic-y, I don't know, engagement party. Here he's really talking about wedding. Let's say an outdoor engagement party just for a modern day kind of context. And the men are kind of gravitating towards this corner. And the women are kind of gravitating towards this corner. Maybe it's not 100%. So you have a Rav in advance. He didn't set up a mechitza per se, but he put like ceramic jugs on the ground. And what are those ceramic jugs going to do? As an example that Abaye put, Rashi explains that, you know, well, if someone's going to try to go over to the other side, they're going to rattle, they'll make noise. Also the reeds, if you pass through weeds, like the wind in the reeds or something like that, it's almost like an alarm system more than a mechitza. It's less than this. It's not so much that we're talking about a physical barrier, like let's say a mechitza at a party. It's more almost like, imagine you had a wire, like an alarm wire that would get tripped if you passed through a certain section of the party. What's also fascinating about this, first of all, just a couple minor things. Number one, Rashi says the scenario is a wedding. He also says the scenario is a drasha, like a Torah lecture. It's just interesting because it's going to come up again in Rashi, we'll see. Number two, here's the thing. On the one hand, you could say, well, maybe this is a basis for separation. Here we have Abaye and Rava who are actively trying to keep men and women from going off together. On the other hand, they didn't really build mechitzot. And this is described as sort of like a unique thing that Abaye and Rava did. And in fact, we don't find it in codifications of Jewish law. This doesn't show up as an obligation of any in any way, shape, or form. So there's a way in which it kind of like goes to both directions. There's some kind of an impetus here that's being recognized to do something to keep men and women from mixing even outside the shul. And on the other hand, it's not really hard and fast and legal the way it's being done. It's so late and there's so much to talk about. I wasn't planning on doing mechitza for. We have to figure out how we can make the most of our time here. Just interestingly, what were some of our sages particularly concerned about of all days? I just find this fascinating. Yantiv. Yantiv was a really dangerous day. It says in the Gemara, Avin says, Sakba Deshata Rigla, the most dangerous time is the regel. And Rashi explains, what's the concern? Well, the men and women are getting together to celebrate, and there's wine flowing, and people get carried away. says it's we think, or I guess I naturally think of Yantiv as a uniquely holy time, but part of the holy time of Yantiv is Simcha and rejoicing. And it's tricky. It's, as we saw with Simcha Beres Shoeva, it can be tricky to have Simcha and rejoicing have the appropriate sort of a tone. Another possible solution is just kind of interesting that comes up. There's Yerushalmi that talks about Boaz gathering elders to witness the wedding that says maybe there's some idea of chaperoning. Okay. Fundamentally, we don't have a lot to go on. We have, I'll just remind you, the Gemara that we saw in Sukkah 2 weeks ago, we mentioned it ago last week, the one that quotes Zachariah saying that in the world of the future, toward the end of days, when there's going to be mourning, at that point, the men and women will mourn separately. And if men and women mourn separately, how much more so that in other contexts they would be separate? And we saw that being connected to Simchat Beit HaShoeva and Beit HaMikdash, and thus because the shul is the Mikdash Me'at to the shul. It's not clear, though, why that would be limited to the shul. Maybe it's more in general. So the evidence is mixed. A few more things that come up in this discussion of what kind of evidence we have. Zimun. And Zimun is a topic we hope to deal with separately in this course. But when it comes to Zimun, men are not supposed to form a Zimun with women, but women and can join a men's Zimun. And we'll talk about that later. In other words, there's a ritual constraint on men and women mixing, but halachically, in terms of eating together, there isn't the constraint. So if we were asking, well, at a meal, can men and women be together? Now, it's not clear necessarily if they're sitting intermixed or to what extent. It's hard to know. But that doesn't seem to be a firm limitation. There's also Rav Moshe Feinstein, who, as we've seen, is a big voice on issues of mechitza. Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about the Mishnah in Pesachim. Mishnah in Pesachim talks about different groups, or what's called a chabura, of people who've in advance arranged to have the Korban Pesach together. And one of the cases that's brought is a kala, a bride. Hiofechet et paneh ve'ochelet. In the case where she's with another group, she turns her head and eats. And the Gemara explains, why is she turning her head to eat? And the answer is, mipnei shi busha, she's embarrassed. Why is she embarrassed? Well, Moshe says, there we go, that's proof. Why should the bride be embarrassed to eat her Korban Pesach when it's with another group? Because the men and women are eating together. And if the Mishnah and the Gemara are talking about the bride being embarrassed, but they're not talking about a mechitza, and they're not talking about there being a prohibition, maybe that's a proof that they could eat together. On the other hand, it's still slippery. Well, were they eating really intermixed? Were the men over here and the women over there, and she was still embarrassed? Or maybe could she have been embarrassed by Uncle Moish? Uncle Moish is there at the table and she hasn't seen him in a long time. In other words, his distant relative. What I'm trying to say is this is more or less what we've got in the Mishnah, in the Talmud on the subject, and it's not a lot. We really don't have clear-cut answers. And what happens basically is that there are developed two main schools of thought for what to do with this material and what to do, as it were, how do you fill in the gap? How do you fill in the gap? So there are two main schools of thought. The one school of thought is to say, we go big. We apply the idea of separation broadly. An example of this is the Gaonic Tshuva here. Asurin hein besuda bizman shehem urbavin elu va'elu ha'anashim va'anashim. It is prohibited for them to have a meal at a time when there are fully intermingled men and women. So you have a position. It exists in early halachic texts. A position that says men and women really should not be intermingling, even outside a shul, at a meal, for example. Okay? That's a broad response. And you even have more modern authorities. This is the Lev Avram, Avram Weinfeld of Muncie, 20th century Rav, who says he wants to say that there's an inyan doraita on a Torah level outside of the shul. So you have this whole kind of perspective that says really, separation is pretty broad. And you have kind of variations on that. So for example, when the Rambam talks about Yontiv, okay, get ready for this. Chayavin Beit Din l'ha'amid shotrim beregalim. The Beis Din needs to appoint like officers, during Yantiv. Shiyu mesavavin umechapsin beginov pardisim. They're going to go around and they're going to check out in the gardens and in the orchards. Valanarot kidei sheloit kapsu lechov lishtotim anashim v'nashim yavol lidei avira. And they're going to make sure that the men and women aren't getting together and mingling too much and coming to sin. V'chein yazhiru b'davar ze lechol ha'am kidei sheloit arvu anashim v'nashim bebateyam l'simcha. And so too, they would warn everybody that men and women shouldn't be mixing together in their homes during the time of simcha. Thus says the Rambam, v'lo yimshechu b'yayin shema yavo lidei avera. And they're going to drink and they're going to come to sin. So the Rambam is focused on Yantiv. Importantly, the Rambam also seems to be connecting this to Seuda, to feasting, to drinking, right? If your main drink at meals, which it was for a lot of human history, was some form of liquor, because water wasn't necessarily reliably hygienic. So if the food, if the drink you're drinking is some form of liquor, that could lead to questions. So there's this kind of perspective that's very, very broad in interpreting where men and women have to be careful outside of the shul. But there's another perspective that's much more narrow. So for example, back to Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin says like this, Nireh lefi aniyatati, she'ein kra de Zecharia osek ela lebatei knesiot ubatei midrashot. Seems to me that this verse from Zecharia is really limited to shul and to the Beit Midrash. Oh, you say, wait a minute, Zecharia was talking about people mourning. How can you say that's limited to shul and Beit Midrash? So he's going to explain. She'esh bem kedusha, v'lo b'shar mekomot. It's specifically those places because they have sanctity, not other places. Shestam hesped shel rabim maspidim b'veit ha'kneset v'lo b'mkom acher. Because the fancy, formal eulogy would typically be done in those days in a shul and not in another place. So again, we have the Talmudic discussion of Simchat Beit HaShoeva, where part of the discussion was this verse from Zechariah, which said men and women would be separate at a time of mourning in days to come. And we learned from that, that if they were separate at this time of mourning, they should be separate more broadly. Now applying that to shul was relatively straightforward because it came out of a discussion of Beit HaMikdash to Beit HaKnesset. And there are those who want to say that it should apply in general, because if it's during mourning that you have to be careful, you should be careful in general. We saw the Rambam and there are others like him who might suggest that, okay, you should be careful maybe in general, but maybe more careful specifically at festive times. In general, maybe we can be a little relaxed, but in festive occasions, especially if the wine is flowing, maybe that's when we have to worry. But now we have a voice like Rav Henkin, which is admittedly a much more modern voice. We'll see a stronger basis for it in a second. We have another voice that says, well, maybe not. Maybe we could read this much more narrowly. Maybe it's really specifically in places with higher kedusha that we have to be more careful about separation. And in other places, less so. And maybe even that could be a precise reading of the verse in Zechariah, because the verse in Zechariah is maybe referring to a eulogy that happens specifically in one of these sacred spaces and not in general. Another way this comes up is, and this is really an interesting earlier source, and we'll see what the Sri Deish does with it, is in the context of the drasha after shul. What goes on in the drasha after shul? So it's actually a really nice test case, right? Because we have the people who give broad application. If you're going to say that separation needs to apply broadly, so the drasha after shul is also a no-brainer. And it's still in shul. If you want to interpret things more narrowly, so is the drasha after shul still shul? Or is it a little different? So here's the Mordechai, he says like this. Mechitza, now his real topic of discussion here is what kind of structures you can make on Shabbat. But along the way, he's going to teach us something about mechitza. Mechitza she'ose l'tzniut be'alma, a mechitza that you make simply for tznius purposes, for purposes of modesty, is mutar. That's permitted to make on Shabbat. Kigam mechitza she'osim b'shat hadrasha, like the mechitza you make during the drasha. Bein anashim lenashim, between men and women, mutar la'asota b'shabbat, that you can make on Shabbos. So back to your two headspaces. Broader approaches to this issue are going to say, aha, there's a machitza here. that the Mordechai is saying is being made even on Shabbos to separate men and women, not just during Shul proper, during the Drasha. That's a proof, broad application. But how will the more narrow approach to applying separation read this source? Here comes the Sridei H again. He said something really interesting. Rak beveit ha-kneset yesh takana k'tuma lasot l'chitzot k'vot. It's only in Shul that we have a very old enactment to make high mechitzas. By the way, do you notice they use the word enactment? So he does not seem to think that it's a Torah level, the mechitza, though we might think separation is on a Torah level, in Shul. Aval basifot shel reshut, but when people come together voluntarily, kigon b'shat hachnasat kala l'chupa, like for a wedding, or b'shat neumim u'drashot, or at the time of a drasha, lo hikpidu me'olam lasot mechitzot. They never were careful about making mechitzas. They would be careful, he says, about men and women not mixing a lot during the drasha, but they wouldn't have actually a mechitza. Indeed, I've seen people bring the Mordechai about this. Okay, now he quotes what we just read about the Shema, and now he's going to explain. Mashma, it sounds from this, she'asu mechitzot gam b'shat ha-drasha. It makes it sound like they make a mechitza also during the drasha. V'lav davka b'shat tfilo kriyashma, not only for prayer. V'nireh, he says, but it seems, he says, she'zo midat chasidut. That's an extra level of stringency or of piety. V'lo mitzad adin, that's not halachically required. We never saw in Lita or Poland that they would insist on erecting a mechitza every time, let's say, a rabbi is giving a speech or every time it's getting the bride to the wedding. Give Israel some credit that if they're not prophets, they're the children of prophets. So he's saying, look, we have to look. We don't have the sources. We have our custom. He says, I look at our custom and I see men and women standing separately in many cases, but I don't see mechitzas everywhere. And he says, furthermore, that Mordechai that you might want to bring as a proof that you need a mechitza for a drasha, it's not a great proof, because remember how the Mordechai called what he did? He called it tzniut be'alma, general modesty purposes. General modesty purposes, he says, the Sridei H says, well, general modesty purposes is more talking about what's stringent or pious behavior. That's not the language you use when something is fully halachically required. Right? You're starting to get the feel for, on some level, how many angles there are to how you could discuss this. And part of the problem as well is that it's slippery. The topic becomes slippery because even if someone's saying a mechitza is not needed, they might think that people are sitting separately. And it's not always clear if they're insisting on it. We don't have time to look at it inside, but I'll just tell you, here I have a source. This is just a source for something that's very common in shuls or during drashas to like lower the mechitza during the drasha. Rav Yaakov Ariel saying, yeah, you can lower the mechitza during the drasha. It's okay. We need it specifically. Even in shul, we need it specifically during tefillah. But when you're listening to the Dvar Torah in shul, it's okay to open up, in his case, he says, roll it up. So it sounds like it's a curtain. Open up that curtain so that women can listen. And from his perspective, that is far, far superior to a situation where women are just talking during the drasha because they can't hear the drasha because the mechitza is getting in their way. Okay. And there's a lot more of this, a lot of different discussions about, they really weren't keeping separate at the chuppah. And if they weren't, why should we have to? And can we trust what the custom was? And Rav Moshe Feinstein offers a slightly different twist on this. So we said that Rav Henkin, in applying things narrowly, wanted to say that the distinction is between the Beit Midrash and the Shul and everywhere else. By the way, I'll just throw out that at Nishmat, there would be events sometimes where men and women would sit together in the Beit Midrash. And I asked Rav Henkin, I said, well, Rav Henkin, according to your logic, how can it be that men and women ever sit together in the Beit Midrash and Nishmat? Like sometimes they sat separately, but every once in a while, there would be something where they would sit together. Maybe things more for the general public where people, I don't know what the reason would be. And he said, well, this really goes by custom. So when I asked Rav Henkin in practice, he said, this custom is informative. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein says the difference isn't between shul, not shul. He says the difference is it an obligatory gathering or is it kind of a private affair? We saw this last time when we talked about the house of mourning, where Rav Moshe said you didn't need necessarily the mechitza in the house of mourning because he viewed it as a kind of private affair. Let me do that over. I think I got it backwards. He thought ideally you would have some separation in the house of mourning because he thought the house of mourning was somewhat public. Anyone comes. But at a wedding where you have to give invitations for someone to come, unlike house of mourning, that's more like a private affair. And there you don't need the mechitza for the people to daven. Now, you saw how I just lost sight of Moshe's logic. It's not totally intuitively simple. That's why. So part of it is maybe because, I could be sharper. But part of it is because the distinction isn't 100% easy to grasp why this space is a public space and this space is a private space. But this distinction becomes very important in Rav Moshe because, for example, he says that a drasha, in particular when there's a potential for kiruv, he says, back to the question of the drasha, he says, you know what? A drasha doesn't necessarily have to have a mechitza. He doesn't say explicitly that it needs separation either. If this is what's going to help people become close to Torah, then, you know, he says, "Im yesh chashash yisarvu lavo, im natzrichem liyot nifradim." If there's a concern that people are not going to be as interested in learning Torah, they're not going to come because we're going to separate them with mechitza, then there's a chance that it's okay. He says, on the one hand, afal pi sheledina tzarich shiyem mechitza, even though fundamentally there should be mechitza. Kefi sheshiv nechdi l'kvod Torah Rama, as my grandson answered for me, kevan shaz manahi l'chol tzibor, because the full community is welcome, i.e. public event for Rav Moshe needs mechitza. It's not just for private people. At the same time, mikol makom, kevan shekan ein efsharut acheret, if there's not really another valid choice, your community is not going to come out to the Torah lecture because they're separate. Okay. So even though Rav Moshe makes this distinction, he's a little bit flexible about this distinction. There's some other interesting ideas as well. Like Rav Uziel was the flip side. We saw people concerned. We saw Rambam being concerned about Davka, specifically a feast where the wine is flowing. So Rav Uziel says, well, you know what? The flip side of this is, what if people are meeting for a serious purpose? In that case, that's different. He says, Ein ha-yeshiva b'mechitza. Ein ha-yeshiva b'mechitza u'kfifa achat l'shem avodat ha-tzibur, shi avodat ha-kodesh. The fact that you have them sitting together for the purpose of the community, which is sacred work, that's not going to lead to sin. And he trusts them. So basically what he's saying is, when people are together and there's seriousness of purpose, we also don't need separation. And this keeps going. The last thing I should mention before I kind of sum up, is one of the cases that comes up a lot is the wedding. And the reason why a wedding comes up is because Sefer Chassidim says that the bracha, one of the brachas of the Sheva Brachot, Shesimcha Bimono, should not be said when men or women are together. Nashim Yashvot Ben Anashim, Shehurim Sham, Lo Yitachen Levarech Shesimcha Bimono. When men and women are sitting together, you can't make this bracha. Because how could it be that joy could really be in God's dwelling when this is happening? So again, broad application. But what's interesting is that there are different approaches to this as well. And I want to conclude with one approach, which is particularly important, and then look at one last source, and then we'll move into questions. So this approach is the Lavush. Lavush says like this, אמרו בספר חסידים, כל מקום שאנשים ונשים רואים זה את זה, כגון בסעודת נישואין, אין לברך ששמחה במונו. The Sefer Hasidim said, you can't make this bracha, sheva brachas, where men and women sit together. Lefi she'ein simcha lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, k'sheyesh bo yehirei avira. Because he says that God is not happy. In fact, there isn't simcha bimono, there isn't joy in God's dwelling, when there's this type of sinful thought, which is inevitable for Sefer Hasidim. Ve'ein nizarin achshav bazeh. This is no longer, this is hundreds of years ago, this is no longer something we're careful about. Perhaps it's because we become habituated to men and women being together. He's not saying there's no inappropriate thoughts ever. He's saying it's not at the same level when there's been habituation. That the men are not thinking of the women all the time in a sexual way. That this is a Talmudic allusion that really requires more explanation than I have time for. Mitoch rov hergelan b'neinu, because they're so accustomed to then, the kivan tadashu dashu, and once it's become something they're accustomed to, it's what they're accustomed to. Okay. Summary, and I want to look at one final source by Rav Nachum Nabinovich, who I think, actually I'm going to let Rav Nachum summarize for us. Okay. What we've seen is a real range of opinions. And again, the real issue is that we've got this big gap. We've got a gap in our Torah data. We don't really know 100% what was done all the time and why. It's not fully clear. And we can fill in the blanks in a lot of different directions. Rav Nachum Rabinovich, I think, really hit the nail on the head when he talked about these issues in a tshuva in his work of responsa, Siach Nachum. People's sensitivity to different things is influenced by their environment. From the policies, from the ways of life that are accepted in a given society. And these different ways of life, these different things that people become accustomed to, they create different responses to different situations, to different phenomena. Klomar, which is to say, לאותה תופעה יתכנו השפעות ותגובות שונות לפי אורחות החיים המקובלות בכל חברה וחברה. It's possible that the same exact scenario in one society will have very different effects and consequences than in another, based on where people are coming from. ואומנם היו אורחות חיים שונות במקומות שונים, and there have always been, there's always been different ways that different people go through life in different places. And the fact of the reality, the social reality that people live in has an influence or an effect on the kviya, on the halachic decision-making that's suitable for a given situation. שהתנאים בחברה קובעים את סף הרגישות לגירויים שונים. Why? Because it's exactly that society's conditions that are going to affect different people's sensitivity. What he's saying, look, outside of, in Shul, it's more clear cut. It's universal. Outside of Shul, exactly what's been done where has really depended on the society. And he's saying that makes sense. Because if our concern is not, as it were, overstimulating the sexual imagination or overly having mixing between men and women, well, that's going to work, or I think different types of interactions are going to have different meanings in different places. וכמו שיש ניסיונות בחשיפה, כך ישנם כנגדם במקום שנקבעים גדרים וסייגים על ידי החברה. He says, you know what? It can be challenging when you're exposed to too much. And there can also be challenges that are going to be brought about by having a lot of fences, or you could say mechitzot. Kol kal tzarich lidog l'tzibur shelo. Every community has to understand its people. Ulinasot she'oto tzibur yinhag l'fi haklalim ha'matimim lo, and that they'll act appropriately. Ulam yesh ladat. However, one should know, ki ma shelo yiyu ha'ne'alim v'haklalim ha'tziburim shikbe'u, you should know that no matter what rules you're going to set, en bi'adam lavtiach miniat kol kishalon, no one is going to have the power to protect everyone from failure all the time. So sofo shel davar kol adam tzarich liyot achrayi bavoit na'agutohu. At the end of the day, every person has to be responsible for his own behavior. Okay, where does this leave us? Again, in Shul, it's more clear-cut. Outside of Shul, not so clear-cut. The Talmudic evidence, the Mishnaic evidence, not 100% in any direction. It's clear that there wasn't full-fledged mixing in every scenario, but it's not clear exactly what the parameters were, or where there actually really would be a mechitza put up. We see different halachic authorities have been strict. Some have been strict in general, some have been more strict in party or frivolous scenarios, some have been specifically more lenient in very serious scenarios, others have distinguished between just the shul and outside the shul. Rav Moshe has this distinction between public events, where he thinks a mechitza would be needed, and private events where he thinks it would not. The bottom line is that a lot of this really seems to be influenced by custom. And what Nachum Rabinovich is saying here is, rightly so, he's saying it should be influenced by custom. It should be informed by how people are. Because if the goal outside the shul, where the halacha is not clear cut, is just to help make sure that we conduct ourselves in line with our values, then that has to be done in a way that makes sense for the community. There's no other choice. And then I think his last point is particularly well taken. On the one hand, halacha is definitely involved in social engineering. That's a lot of what this subject has been about, right? Is how to create, even when you're not praying, how to create an atmosphere that's going to lend itself to sanctity. And back to Rav Cook's question with which we started off, to what extent are we willing to give up on possible positives of interaction in order to pursue a kind of ideal of holiness? And at the same time, that there's a lot to be said for that, Rav Nachum is coming up and he's saying, well, when all is said and done, you can have a mechitza, you cannot have a mechitza. There are costs sometimes to having one, and there are costs sometimes to not having one. No matter what you do, no matter how much social engineering it is, people have to take responsibility for their own behavior. It's not ultimately going to be up to the mechitza. It's going to be up to you. It puts me in mind of a saying I particularly am fond of by Emmanuel Levinas, where he said, Judaism is a religion for adults. You know, at the end of the day, the mechitza is not going to be the thing that makes the community. A mechitza might be appropriate for a given scenario in a given community. It's not cut and dry all the time. We can respect that there can be different standards and different authorities that a community could rely on for leniency or for stringency. But at the end of the day, we have to try our best to be adults. Tov, shall we talk about some of the comments?
Yes. Yeah, so before I do that, I sent out an email, but I do want to thank orally and publicly Susan Lapel for sponsoring the shiur today. An observant, it was on the email. I'm sorry I didn't mention it earlier, so I'll mention it now, right? For her, the yahrzeit of her husband on the 18th of Tevet, her brother Michael on the 13th of Tevet, and her brother Avram on the 20th of Tevet. So, wow. A difficult week, and we wish should have happy occasions and good health and smachot and reason to celebrate. So thank you for that. And learning is always the link between a Torat Chaim, the life of learning, the Eitz Chaim, and those who are no longer with us in a physical sense, but remain in a spiritual sense. So thank you very much. Okay, Lori, I'm happy to go through the questions with you as usual. So we'll start. Okay. The Aruch Shulchan and Mishnah Berurah pointing out, yes, by their time, 19th century, 20th century, beginning of 20th century, there were women coming to shul. Well, unlike in the Maharal's time where they had to add it much later in the thickness of the wall. Okay. If the man and the Nashim can join, then how can the woman say Kedusha, right? If the men are, if that man can't join, how can the woman say Kedusha? If the woman section is not considered part of the minyan, so how are the women, when they answer Kedusha, how does that work? I mean, okay,
so what I was trying to say is that there are two different factors here. One is, can the person in the woman's section help to create the minyan? And the second question is, can the person in the women's section be part of, halachically part of, communal prayer? So when it comes to can a person in a woman's section help create a minyan, And usually the test case is going to be a man, right? There's some debate, and it might depend on whether or not the mechitza goes to the ceiling. It might depend on whether or not there are windows. But when it comes to the question of can a man or a woman who's davening in the women's section be a part of communal prayer halachically, that communal prayer is theirs along with the rest of the community, that's 100%. That doesn't depend.
That's, by the way, and you froze for half a minute, I don't know, or a little bit. Maybe it's I froze, but that's the issue really on Zoom minyanim. The assumption of many people is that you have 10 people in shul make the minyan, then anybody else who's on Zoom can participate in the minyan. I think that's become a pretty well accepted view within the Orthodox world that doesn't want to create a minyan only through Zoom. They want to have the minyan in person. But I know they encourage people to come and even to say Kaddish. Once there's a minyan in shul, the people who are in Zoom, which is much further away than any mechitza, so to speak, can be part of the minyan too, right? So we have that distinction.
Well, we definitely had a lot of very creative test cases for that whole world of halacha over the past year, and different approaches, but it hasn't been easy.
Yes. Okay. iPad is pointing out if there's no window, that means the mothers couldn't see. Yes, that was last week's discussion pretty much. I guess, you know, is the mechitza so you can't see, can't interact. And I think all of us on this class and sort of in the modern Orthodox world all assume would not want to daven in the shul in a mechitza where the woman can't see. That's for sure, I would think.
Well, actually, just to go back to the thing in the beginning, that's what's so interesting. There are people who don't want to see. So I'm just saying that many people would assume that there are people who do not want to see. There really are. But I would say that's probably true of the majority. I would say the majority of women probably do want to be able to see, at least let's say Hagba. You know, Shulchan Aruch says you're supposed to be looking at the Sefer Torah during Hagba. You know, I think that's true of most people. But yeah, there are those interesting, there are people who that's not an issue for them. So it's just
I'll just say in the minyan that I daven at on Shabbos, the way they run the minyan, we're five backyards pretty much, and they give aliyot, but I can be 50. I'm literally probably 40 feet away from where the Sefer Torah is being read from, and they'll give me an aliyah. I don't see the Sefer Torah. I can sort of see the Bakori. In the summer, I couldn't because of all the trees. In the winter, it's easier to see through. But so even the people getting Aliyot don't see the Torah. I mean, I know there are different views on that, but that's how the Minyan I go to operate. So it's interesting how that concept sort of even on the men, if I could say. Someone wants to point out how the emotional, how does it feel to be part of a the woman's section, not so holy. You know, the Kedusha is less. If you want to address that.
Well, I mean, you could say that it's convenient, right? Meaning, I personally, and I think I mentioned this in the Shira, I really connect with the Aruch HaShulchan saying, look, it's in Shul, it's a place where people are praying. It's got the same sanctity. That's something that personally speaks to me. At the same time, there can be certain advantages, women with children who might want to be bringing in toys or games or books and eating. And, you know, I mean, men do that too nowadays. It's not like a trivially simple thing for all that to be going on in shul. There could be in some cases that sense of being more relaxed. I think in, let's say in Sephardi shuls, there's often a kind of different culture where, let's say something like slichot. You know, slichot in a Sephardi shul could be, at least I'm told, that you come in and everyone's sitting around with a nice hot cup of coffee around a table, and it's just sort of like very, very warm and civilized in a certain way, but very sort of almost homey. Almost homey. Well, unslichot stick to you, right? That's the point.
I mean, I say that as a joke, but the way we Ashkenazim view slichot is the opposite. That's when we're fasting, and you know, it's kind of interesting.
So yeah. It's a different. You could almost call it a vibe. So of course, when you're in shul and when you're davening, it's you and Hashem. That's always true. But the idea that there would sort of be a that your place of prayer might be a little more flexible might sometimes work to someone's advantage, their comfort level of doing what they need to do. So I could see that as a potential positive. It's not simple just because, you know, of course it raises these questions like what we were saying before. So you're part of the Tefillah B'Tzibur, but somehow what your space has less Kedusha because the minion's not in it, you know, and what is it really, does that make the difference or not? So again, you can say that it did, you can say that it does. You can say that it does, and sort of like the central locus in Shul is the minion. Or you can say that the communal prayer, once there is a minion, the communal prayer is the central thing that that's about, and then it's all the same, right? So it maybe depend on which of those you're focusing on in your thinking.
Okay, Susanna's just pointing out that there's custom has to follow the ways. There's very few sources that for that purpose. We don't want to have the story. As Rav Nachum Rabbanovich, as you were pointing on the end, I'll add, you know, it's interesting, like some of the most important things in life, we have very few sources on in our tradition. And I think what job a person should do, what you should do with your life, because when it comes, the Torah, as I understand it, is to regulate what we do. But what we do is up to us. The Torah is not going to tell you what profession to go into, what to do with your life, but whatever you do, do it in a moral way with integrity. So the Torah often ignores the most basic questions of life in a strange way, but that's a little bit beyond what we're discussing now. Yeah. This example of the mechitza is just
I think it is a really good point. I think one thing that's a little tricky here is that there's supposed to be a consciousness. Though I think that does come across the board with the sources. In other words, the sources that are saying that they're the approach that's taking a more broader view and saying there really need to be kind of mechitzot or at least separation all over the place. And still the sources that are taking a different view and saying, no, there's been habituation. This isn't what was customary. It's not clear from the Makorot that that's what's needed. It's not in shul, whatever it is. There's still that kind of, I think there's still supposed to be, or it comes through as still a sense of sensitivity, and that's hard to maintain. And I think that's what's tricky, that I think we have that sense of, well, this is what we've always done for chuppahs makes sense. The question of how do you maintain within the world of this is all what we've always done and what Rabbi Jay is saying, this is what we've always done, so it didn't necessarily need to get written down because it's just what we've always done. How do you maintain their sensitivities to things that aren't always obvious? It's a little trickier. I'll just give you a little example, which is kind of interesting. You know, and here, and I'm not even sure anymore how it works in America because I've been in Israel now for so long. Generally speaking, if I go to a wedding, you know, there might be a table, a square table. So some weddings really are separate, and that's a different experience. Some weddings are mixed, and at a mixed wedding, generally speaking, if I'm there, I'll sit next to women. Now, if I'm there with my husband, he'll sit next to me, and very often next to him will be another man. And sort of like the couples will do it, that the men are sitting next to each other and the women are sitting next to each other. It often works out that way. Not rigidly, like let's say, you know, there's the wrong number of people at the table, or, you know, that guy sat down before he figured out what the pattern was. You know, I don't think people don't too often in my experience, you know, get up and insist on switching seats, like or something like that. But there, it's just sort of interesting that it's sort of like it's not a rule, but it's sort of like this tendency to be, well, if we're sitting together, it would be natural for a woman to sit with her husband or with another woman beside her, and not necessarily to be sitting with another man. I think with singles, it really varies. At some of these weddings, the single tables are separate, and at some of the tables, some of them they're mixed and some of them they're more separate, but with married couples, somehow it seems to be much more kind of clear. Like that's the tendency, even if it's not a rigid tendency. And I think that's the kind of thing we're talking about, right? It's not a mechitza. And in this case, it's not even really separate seating. And like I said, people aren't rigid about it. And it's not necessarily in every circle, but there's just a little bit of sensitivity about who's sitting next to who, when and why, and what that might mean. And it's interesting. And I still might wind up having a conversation with a man at the table, but I'm not sitting right next to him. So inherently, that conversation is not going to be the same level of private. It will be, you know, involving other people as well, or potentially involving other people as well. It changes the dynamic a little bit. Dancing, I think, is another interesting example. We didn't have really time to go into it. So dancing, there's nice amount of sources about dancing being separate. Does there have to be a mechitza for separate dancing? It's very customary that there should be a mechitza for separate dancing. Is it 100% required? Again, maybe it depends on the type of dancing, right? Like, you know, you have, back to my life in Israel, it's very much in style for the younger people these days to have very, very free, very, very lively, full body dancing, where I think it is much more comfortable in that case for there to be a mechitza. But then there, you know, there are those events where they call it dancing, but you're really walking around in a circle. Yeah. Some of you have had that experience. It's not exactly dancing. Maybe you're keeping a rhythm. Not necessarily, as crystal clearly as Rav Henkin says, for example, that doesn't necessarily have to be a mechitza in that scenario. Maybe it's preferred. Doesn't have to be. So I think you're right. We don't necessarily want that to be rigid. I do think that there's this place where there's supposed to be kind of like that sense of, well, maybe I will dance a little differently if there is a mechitza, from how I'll dance if there's not a mechitza. In some ways, that even might connect to what we were saying earlier about ecstatic prayer, right? Maybe depending on what the mechitza is, that prayer might be more ecstatic in the women's section, or it might be more contained, or in the men's section, what that means. So there's a lot of really interesting intangibles here. And then the point is that we have to make the mechitza the tool and not the end of the story. All right, what else we got here?
That does happen, by the way, in North America, the men, women sitting the way you describe, I believe. And anyways, okay, yes, somebody pointing out to respect each other as human beings, and obviously the different societies will affect what type of mechitza we have. Diane is pointing out that men and women sitting separately in the at meals, on Friday meals. So that's... As I was listening, you know, the Chafetz Chaim was very much opposed to that. It's the halacha is that a man must eat with his wife. It's actually in the Mishnah that you have to eat together on Friday night as a bare minimum. For a businessman who goes away all week, right? The Mishnah, I believe, discussed that, how much time a man has to spend with his wife. So they have to eat together. And I assume together means in the same room, not that the wife's in the kitchen. But that's... what can I tell you? I think, Diane, that's referring to that some places they do that. Some things haven't changed. Yeah.
Also, it's funny, but, you know, are the husband and wife sitting next to each other at the table, or are they at different ends of the table?
Yeah, that's, but there may be practical reasons for that.
That mean something? We have British friends who are very, they've actually, when we coming to our own home, it's been very important to them that one is at the head and one is at the foot.
Even in your house.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a little interesting. Okay.
It is interesting. It is interesting.
Diane's also pointing out, right, an issue you didn't really address, but it's not about bat mitzvah girls speaking in shul like before Adon Olam, like, you know, some shuls insist that's be after Adon Olam because it shouldn't be quote unquote part of the service or not. So that's I think that's under flux. You can, your comments, please.
Yeah, that's really a different question, because that's not about the men and women mixing. That's about a woman taking a public role in shul. So they're basically, that's, it's more or less it's another area in which we don't have a lot of explicit halachic information. We have halachic information about, let's say, women and Torah reading, women for different reasons. Halachically, women aren't going to be able to be shaliach tzibur, but the idea of can a woman have a speaking role in shul? It's less explicitly clear cut in the sources. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about it. I understand that it might have been written actually in the context of Nechama Leibovich, who was, you know, one of the first. She was known. It's an interesting thing about her. She taught chumash in yeshiva at different points. She would go to shuls sometimes and speak. So there's a question about what was appropriate, and I think there he was not. He really wanted to keep a pretty clear distinction. He thought there was room for a woman to be speaking Torah to men and women, but he didn't think that belonged in the shul setting. So then the question becomes, well, what are the parameters of that? And different people have different ways of kind of handling it. But so it's a little bit of a different topic.
Right. Well, okay. Susanna sort of pointing out, I don't know if that's exactly her comment or question, but you know, I've always find strange is you have this more, well, whatever, you go to the shmorg before the wedding, very firm weddings, very yeshivish weddings. So the men and women, everything's mixed. And, you know, shmorg, they're actually touching each other because they're big and they got to get the sushi and, you know, this one. And you're actually touching men and women together, mamash. And then the wedding, chas v'shalom, if there's not a mechitza 15 feet tall, it's such a whatever.
That's so free for all was at the chuppah.
I'm sorry?
Free for all was at the chuppah.
The greater free for all is at the shmorg, though. You go to the shmorgs, it's a total free for all. They bring out the who knows what, and people.
I don't remember. I mean, this was in 1971. I don't remember a smorgasbord, but there is a.
No, in Canada, Baruch Hashem. Well, we've learned the bad habits, but it used to be they never had a shmorg in Canada, Baruch Hashem. But they picked up some of the New York bad habits.
You know? Moshe has a series of tshuvas. The truth is, they don't all line up in a totally neat way. But, you know, he talks about there being some logic to let's say, making distinction between a smorgasbord where you should be maybe more careful because
right, that's,
people aren't
that's
really fixed in place, and like tables where maybe you can be more relaxed because
right,
people are set in place. I have to say, in my personal experience, I've seen like every variation under the sun of what's mixed and what's not mixed or it all being separate or, you know, it's complicated. Some of it's logistics, some of it's custom. Some of it is more halachic because on some level with this issue, right? If your halachic authority is taking the broad approach, then part of what that broad approach entails, saying there needs to be more separation, is saying that it's halachic in more cases, that it's halachically required. And if the approach is narrow, then you're saying that in some of the cases it's really not halachic. So it's all over the place. It's all over the place. There's no other way to put it.
Okay. Two interesting points I think we can address, hopefully, and then we'll let you go. Somebody asking about the LGBT community, which you sort of alluded to the issue, but you never got there. Maybe you don't want to deal with now. I can understand. Or maybe if you want to pick up with that next week, the LGBT community. And the other interesting question is somebody asked about when davening in shuls that no longer functions in shuls. Like you go on a trip to Poland, as I said, you don't need the mechitza. Well, that sort of relates to what you said in the Shivas. But I think
that one is more about, you know, if it's a one-off as opposed to a set place of prayer. You know, when something is a one-off, even if it used to be a set place of prayer, there can be room for more flexibility. LGBT is really complicated with these halachos, with this discussion, social discussion as well, because really Chazal and early halachic authorities are working from the assumption that it's a... that it's really a very, very, that it's rare, that it's not a common thing for someone to be, for someone to have same-sex desire or let me put it a little differently, for someone to have, to be looking to live a lifestyle in that fashion. That's the starting place. And because that's the starting place, it's not coming up as being, I mean, we saw, like I showed you a tshuva about women looking at the men's section. So women be at all thinking about women as being the subject or the source of thinking sexually is less common. In our traditional literature, there's much more. The basic assumption is that men's sexual drives are going to be harder to control or more blatant, which you could say is borne out, but different people have different experiences. And of course, there's a lot of variation. So that's already that there's differences between men and women. When we throw in different gender categories and we throw in people who are attracted to the same gender, it would be very hard to make rules because ultimately no one would be allowed to be with anybody else, right? Everyone would have to be radically separate to be careful for everything. So it makes sense to say that you're going to go with that you're going to go with trying to, your social engineering is going to focus on what you think the prevalent concern is. That makes a lot of sense. The tricky thing is that now, as we become more aware of this, even talking about these issues can wind up being very painful for people who don't fit neatly in these categories. And that's it's a whole other level of discussion, meaning there's the question of how does someone navigate a situation where it's assumed that everything is free, specifically in the scenario where they feel that they need to be more constrained, but then things are more constrained in situations where they feel they might personally be able to be more free. That can be a real challenge. But more than that, the whole way that we've been talking can just be hard and alienating, because on some level we're saying, well, we're setting this up based on a majority that you're not in. It becomes a consistent message of not fitting. And that's very, very difficult. There's not an easy solution to that. I mean, one thing, and I think actually you've just done it, and I thank you for it. One basic thing is just to acknowledge, at least we can start with that. We can acknowledge that not everyone is in the same place on these issues. Even people who are generally speaking attracted to a different gender might sometimes have same-sex attraction. Like, we can acknowledge that these categories are not always as clear-cut as they might be. We can also accept that halacha is going to work with what they think of as being the most probable issues. And then I think the other thing we have to do is we have to try to be sensitive. So, like, one of the things, for example, is this is going to sound so basic, but I don't think it's so basic. Are we welcoming of different types of people in the men's and women's sections? Or is someone who isn't fully gender conforming made to feel uncomfortable, so that even if they're going into the official section that they belong in, they're being given subtle signals by other people that they don't belong? You know what I mean? There's like a whole world of ways in which we can try to be, we can just try to be more sensitive and accepting of people and where they are and how they're experiencing things. We can also try, when we're the same way that we're really supposed to have sensitivity about potential inappropriate interactions is supposed to be something that we're sensitive to between men and women. I think we can be increasingly sensitive to the idea that some of those issues could also come up in same gender spaces. And it's just something that would probably be healthy for people to be aware of, that, you know, that you can't just take that for granted either. And you want to make it a safe space for everybody in that way. Like, you know, it's not necessarily the case that, oh, we're in an all women environment, therefore can feel completely free because no one here will ever be experiencing same-sex attraction. Maybe that's not the case, right? So there can also be, I think, another level of sensitivity and even sometimes caution. But to some extent, this is really this is how the system works. The system is distinguishing on the whole between men and women. Something that's kind of also tricky, it's a kind of a whole other discussion, is with transgender now, and how that fits in terms of leaving aside questions of what's permitted or not permitted for someone in that situation to do, where they go in shul and what's appropriate is a whole other world of questions. It's not easy. It's not easy. At the same time, I don't know that it's as if we can try to do things in a sensitive way, it's probably healthy for us to be aware of the fact that it's not easy, and to be, you know, if that leads us to thinking about how we do things in a more conscious way, that could potentially be to everybody's benefit. But yeah, and I don't have easy answers to those questions, not at all.
Beautifully said, Lori. I will say, very we are the first generation where LGBT Jews want to be part of our community. And some shuls are welcoming, and unfortunately, many are not, and we're dealing with the issue, you know. And I'm sure, I think there's been a world of change for, I say, like from my generation to our kids' generation, just the whole attitude towards the greater acceptance, you know, just what, you know, and the fact that YU last week, I don't know, part of why I'm not getting into that issue, but they had, you know, about 600 people online for a sort of a panel of these like students of YU dealing with LGBT and orthodoxy. I can tell you the most popular of our, you know, many hundreds of Shirim that we have, and, you know, we had thousands really before we started, you know, Zoom and everything. We did do on YouTube, one of you is our LG, we did two LGBT panels, and those are by far being the ones that have been the most watched, where we had, you know, two serious panels, you know, with LGBT people and Chaim Rappaport and Steve Greenberg, and you know, the range, and really a serious discussion on a very serious issue. But, you know, but anyways, that's really not, that's just, you know, that's one segment of the Mechitza issue, but of course it's a much broader issue in other areas. Anyways.
But then, I mean, it's like everything else. Mechitza is about community, right? It's about how we form our community, and when it's important for our community to function, when our community works on more automatic, and when it's important for a community to maybe put up certain barriers, and when that's well considered. And this is also, I think it's similarly, it's a question about community. I don't think, I'm not comfortable with people who say halacha is a problem. And I'm not comfortable with people who say, God forbid that, you know, also God forbid that we'd say halacha is a problem, and God forbid we would say LGBT people are a problem. I don't think that's the right way to look at it. I think the question is, how do we need to act as a community?
Okay, on that note that everybody can think about and can try to solve the problem, it is a tough problem. It is, and whatever.
Are problems, but it's not that halacha is the problem.
No, it's a terrible whatever. It's what, okay. Enough said for now.
We could go on forever.
Really, I do recommend, if you're interested, you can watch our panel. It's on our YouTube, I think the front page of the Torah Motion YouTube panel on that. Laurie, we look forward next week on Zimun, Birchat HaMazon, right? That's our topic.
That's right.
For next week. Tai Nevarech, okay, or whatever we're going to say. And this evening at 8 p.m., Moshe Sokolov on the Haftorah of the week, Parshat Shmot, we're beginning, Sefer Shmot. And tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Shuli Mishkan begins a new series. She hasn't taught for a while, though, a couple months ago, on based Second Temple period. The Rise and Fall of the Second Temple Times, I think, is the official title. And I think we're starting with King Herod, who, of course, was the one who expanded the Second Beit HaMikdash. So that's a show and tell. Lots of pictures and descriptions. So everybody, welcome. If you haven't registered, you do need to register, of course, for that, if you haven't yet. And then tomorrow night, Nati Helfgott, Rabbi Nati Helfgott of Tinek, Nitivat HaShalom, Rabbi Nitivat HaShalom in Tinek, will be giving our